And also started on streaming it to Facebook. And that should be good there. And as usual, just try to keep yourself muted unless you have a question. And now I'll turn it over to Guy to start the meeting officially. Thank you.
Okay, so it's 7:30 on September the 9th of 2022, and I'm the new president of NCA. I hope not to mess up the club too bad during my year or so. It's done some very interesting things. I personally benefited from it. I think we have made a significant impact in letting lots of people come to our meetings, either remotely or in person, seeing the stars for themselves in Rock Creek Park almost every month, or most months, let's put it that way, except for the last 2 years, helping people make telescopes, helping people at encouraging young people at science fairs. We've had an impact, and I actually knew both Vera Rubin, worked with her at the Carnegie Institution as a teacher of kids and science, sort of enrichment on weekends. And if you were here with the other lady whose name for
Nancy Grace Roman.
thank you, Nancy Grace Roman. I'll go to introduce my wife, and it's a, this is my wife. Forgetting me. It's embarrassing. But in any case, got to know her. And if you were at the meetings, she was an incredibly sharp person. She would always come up with incredibly cogent questions on lots of topics that people were giving their talk to about. And it was, I didn't meet know her when she was young and actually actively working, but she was they're both amazing. And I hope to sort of no way I'm gonna fill any of those shoes. Well, I hope to keep this going for the next year or so. I'm very pleased with the new board of directors, and I really want to tremendously thank our new treasurer, Jim Simpson. And if you didn't know, the other is his predecessor, Henry Bofinger, Heinrich Bofinger, has been disabled, and it was bit of work getting it moved over to new treasurer. It took an hour or so, a bunch of us waiting around in a bank for them to do something. Okay, so I'm going to turn this over to John Hornstein at this point, who's one of the other people who is most important in keeping this club going, because he is the one who, for I don't know how many years now, has been actively going around and getting hold of people to speak to us. And not everybody's going to say yes. And I've really been impressed so far with all of the meetings that I've gone to. I don't go to, haven't gone to everyone in the past. I will have to do so from now on. Okay, so
I'd like a brief announcement.
yes, we should have announcements. Yes,
Right.
who go ahead.
The Mid-Atlantic Senior Physicist Group will have a talk, Asteroids, the Stepping Stones to the Future of Space Exploration, by Michael Azoki from the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at Clarkson University. This talk will be at one, well, it will be a Zoom meeting. It starts at 1 p.m. It will be on Wednesday, September 28th, which is the fourth Wednesday rather than the usual third Wednesday. There is an announcement on page 7, the calendar on page 7 in Stardust, and there is a link to register for the meeting. And if you register, the APS will then send you the link to join the Zoom meeting.
Can I make a suggestion? Can you also put something in the next couple minutes into the chat box? Just remind people about this. Okay. Who else has? Thank you. Thank you very much for that announcement. Who else has an announcement?
Not an announcement, but I came in late. I think we should put a nod for Frank Drake.
Oh, please.
Yeah.
Well, he just, other people will know better than I. I think he just passed away this week.
He did. Yeah. He was an interesting pioneer. We still don't know if there is anybody out there. It is true. He just passed away. I'm not going to do a funeral eulogy for him. Any other announcements?
David will have one, but he's trying to get ready.
Yeah, David. I just wanted to remind people of the Uranus occultation coming up, occultation of 11.9 magnitude star by Uranus that's coming up on the 13th, about midnight. So it's actually the evening of the 12th. I have some local times in the Stardust. But I think I just gave the central time there. So I was going to give the, because it's a 92 minute event. So the disappearance will occur much earlier than the time given in Stardust. But it's not a real easy event to observe. I was going to send out a message that gives detailed predictions for different places to the listserver so that people could find the times for their location. The problem with the star's almost 12th magnitude and the planet's 6 magnitudes brighter. The only thing you can see really will be the disappearance of the star behind the epsilon ring, the outer ring of Uranus. Even that, the star will be within just under 2 seconds of arc from the edge of the much brighter planet. So it's going to be a quite difficult event. Only chance of really observing it is using a red filter or a methane band filter to cut down the light of Uranus. With a methane band filter, you can cut it down a lot. With a red filter, you could probably cut it down enough to see it if the seeing conditions are good enough to see the
Okay. Thank you. If you can put some that into the chat, and again, remind people via the listserv, that would be helpful. And speaking of the listserv, we do have a listserv. If you're not on it, you can put a note to me in the chat and I can add you to it. It's easy. We don't have a lot of spam. Actually, I don't see any, but they're interesting discussions of various topics and announcements. Any other announcements from anybody? Okay, let's turn it over to John Hornstein and he will give us a little intro to our speaker.
It's a great pleasure to greet our speaker this evening, Dr. Quanxi. He's a planetary astronomer in the Department of Astronomy of the University of Maryland and is also a visiting researcher at Boston University. He focuses on comets and asteroids and how these bodies evolve as they orbit the sun. Astronomers call these objects small bodies, but their small size belies their importance. Because many of them are fossils that embody the early stages in the formation of the solar system. And they tell us a lot about how the solar system formed and how it has changed and how it's changing. Dr. Ye uses the Canadian Meteor Orbit Radar to study meteor showers, as well as the Zwicky Transient Facility project at Palomar Observatory to find near-Earth asteroids and comets. Jointly with acclaimed astrophotographer from Taiwan, Chi Sheng Lin, Dr. Ye co-discovered the Naked Eye Comet in 2009. Its official number is C/2007N3, or Lulin. And he has since discovered three more comets. He also discovered 11 comets in the images taken by the SOHO spacecraft back in 2005-2006. That's a spacecraft that was designed to study the sun. Dr. Ye helps to maintain NASA's Planetary Data System database on small bodies, and he also studies objects that have been ejected from other planetary systems and are now passing through our solar system. These too are small bodies, and we look forward to hearing about them now. Dr. Ye.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, John, and thank you all NCA for inviting me to speak. It's really great to be here. So hi, my name is Pongji, and I'm now physically at Boston, but still working at UMD. So I guess I can still consider myself as half BC resident, I guess. So I can already see that it's really like a friendly and cordial group. So maybe I can start saying a few things about myself. So I grew up in the southern city of Guangzhou in China. Its historic name is Canton. Maybe that name is more familiar. And I was just chatting with Guy, and we mentioned that Canton, the Canton of Baltimore, is actually received name because there's a connection. There's a regular merchant link that links Baltimore and Canton back, I think about 200 years ago, because Canton was, and still is, a major trading part of China. And I think there's something like 5 or 10 other towns that are named Canton in the US. So that I think that's an interesting connection. I am working in, you know, the field of astronomy right now, but I first started as a stargazer, like stargazer. I like to go out, have fun, and remind me about my roots, even though it usually does not have anything to do with my research. Though occasionally it does, because I'm studying small bodies in the solar system, and sometimes these objects can get pretty bright, just like bright comets and stuff. So, okay, that's a bit about me. So maybe we should move into the talk, otherwise it's going to last 2 hours or so. So today I'm going to talk about interstellar visitors, small bodies that happens to pass through our solar system. And I guess as a teaser, I will probably start with this image. Can everybody see my laser pointer?
Yeah.
Yes, great. Okay, I will start with this image. I really like it. And this is an image from the Hubble Frontal View, or HFF. It's a program. It's a pretty large program that uses the Hubble Space Telescope to, the idea is to use Hubble to continuously image a certain part in the sky with the goal of trying to go as deep and as far as you can. And I think this is really great, even though I'm not, you know, this program is, I think, cosmological and extragalactical program, because the further, the further and the fainter you go, you can see really a lot of galaxies, and many of them are very far away. But even though I'm not doing those fields professionally, I'm still amazed because this is a very good reflection of how vast and how sophisticated our universe is, and also astronomy is. And astronomy is a pretty big field. There are many subfields. Sometimes we joke that you have actually it's a truth. If, for example, I am a planetary astronomer, if I go to talk to somebody who's doing galactical astronomy, then you know I feel it's little difference compared to talking to maybe a biologist, because you are essentially doing very different things. You can share. You do know some basic physics, but on top apart from that, you're basically asking things like, "Oh, so why is this important?" You're asking all these like elevator questions. But occasionally, these different subfields do intersect with each other. For subfields, there are different ways to divide things. We can divide things by the means. There are observational astronomy, theoretical astronomy, and astronomers who do instruments. Okay, and if we divide by object types and distance, we have planetary astronomy, which can be further divided into solar system and extrasolar planets astronomy. We have the sun, heliophysics. Some call it heliophysics. We have folks who study stars in the Milky Way galaxy, and occasionally stars in other galaxies too. That's stellar astronomy. And we have folks that study galaxies. We have folks that study cosmology. How the universe evolves into the current state. So here you can see several of these subfields. We see tons of galaxies, different types, different distance, different color, or different color cells are the difference. We have stars, and I will say most, if not all, the stars within here are from within the Milky Way galaxy, okay? But if you pay attention to it, you can see that there are a lot of curvy stuff here. You have a quartet here, you have a triplet here, you have a pair here, right? And without further ado, these are actually the objects in our own solar system. And this image is processed in a special way to preserve these targets, because folks, the HFF folks, they don't want this. To them, these are the foreground contaminations. But of course, for us planetary astronomers, this is very interesting, because these are the things that we are interested in. And I could probably go for another 2 hours just to talk about this picture. But the things I want to point out here is that you'll be amazed how many things that you can extract from data. Sometimes the data that sometimes not designed to do your own research in your field. Here you see that the asteroids are in the you can see that there are certain pattern. And why is that? Well, this is because they're actually the same object. Hubble observed this field for a long time, but it cannot do continuous integration, okay? Because it orbits around the Earth, and sometimes the Earth blocks the field. And sometimes you need to stop the camera because you're reading all the data. And at the same time, the asteroid is also moving. So by the time that it starts the next exposure, actually, as time passed, this as Hubble orbits around the sun, this asteroid will start, moving from pixel to pixel, effect that known as parallax. You might have heard of parallax, how astronomers use distance to stars, to very distant stars. But any object that at a distance from us will have parallax. If you, the observers, are moving. And the asteroids themselves are also moving. That's why, this one curve, from here to here, is actually caused by, primarily caused by the motions of Hubble around the Earth. But as Hubble started integrations at the next orbit around the Earth, that the asteroids has actually already moved here. And then the next here. That's why you're seeing, this, certain patterns, they're actually, caused by the same asteroids. And asteroids can also change brightness. You can see that this one, although this and this are from the same asteroid here, the asteroid is a bit fainter than here, probably because the asteroid is rotating and stuff like that. Okay, so this is a bit teaser. It doesn't really mean that I'm not going to talk about these asteroids, but just to show you something that I find really cool. And on this regard, solar system astronomy and exoplanetary astronomy, solar system, or, you know, and if we go a little further in history, you know, astronomy at the beginning was mostly about solar system because, you know, you know, our ancestors didn't have access to telescopes. So they could see like a lot of stars and of course, you know, the naked eye planets, that's all they can see. And they were trying to make sense what's happening about all this stuff. But after we have telescopes and better and better telescopes and other, you know, all these folks figure out what's going on in the solar system, astronomers start to go beyond the solar system. So at that time, you know, astronomy started to become an ever involving subject. And the exoplanet science didn't actually start it. Depends on how you measure it, but I guess we could all agree that, you know, it wasn't as a field. It wasn't here as a field until maybe 30 years ago when the first exoplanet was actually discovered. And for a long time, the solar system, as solar system side of planetary astronomy and the exoplanet side of exoplanet are largely like, you know, two continents. Not because we don't like each other, but because there is a big difference between how we study things and how we interpret the data. For stuff that are in the solar system, we can resolve them. You know, if you go out, you can see comets. If there's a bright comet, you can see comets. You can identify individual small bodies, planets of all kinds of stuff in the solar system. But for exoplanet science, and most of the time, you can't do that because they're just too far. They're too far away. And you just, in many cases, you can't resolve them or you can't directly detect them. So this is why, you know, even though we are all both called planetary astronomy, there is actually a big difference between the two sides of planetary astronomy. Until here is where things go interesting. Until about 5 years ago, when spoiler alert, the first interstellar small body was discovered. Although this is still, you know, a very new field, this opens a small window of possibility that we can actually start to study things that are originated from another solar system. Okay, so I guess this is long enough to use a talk, so let's continue. And I think it would be good to very briefly look at when we talk about small bodies in the solar system, what do we mean? Here is a picture that you can find in many encyclopedia and beginning level astronomy books. This is a map, not to scale, the solar system. Here we have our central star sun, and we have eight planets, or nine, depends on whether you like Pluto or not. We also have a large number of small bodies. We have asteroid belt that's between Mars and Jupiter that contains at least a million known asteroids. We also have comets that orbit the sun in more elongated orbits. And beyond the orbit of Neptune, we have Kuiper belt, and ultimately we have the Oort cloud. And all these four populations are referred to as small bodies. So there's a one concise summary about the solar system that I really like that goes a small number of big planets and a large number of small planets. And the small planets are really, well, actually let's first take a quick look at what the small bodies really mean. So asteroids derive its name from the Greek word that I don't know how to pronounce, but I heard that it means star-like stuff. Well, star-like object, I think that's what it means. And it's exactly what they look like. So they are exactly what this name implies if you point your telescope to the night sky. So here it's animation of a near-Earth asteroid, image by somebody. And you can see that the asteroid is moving in the star background, and it's largely, it is star because it's small and a ground-based telescope typically can't resolve them. And it's also moving, they're moving very fast. Usually you can see quite a dependable motion over a time span of maybe like 20 to 30 minutes. Because they're so close to us, right? You can actually see their motion. But of course, now we are in a space era and we have sent spacecrafts to visit some of the asteroids. We also have powerful radar that can give us a high resolution and sometimes time-resolved picture of time-resolved data of asteroids. So asteroids, as we know about them, are really spherical. Actually, all of them. Various shapes. They can be like a bomb, like a potato, or sometimes like a very strange shape. And this is because they're so small, okay? And their gravity is so small that they can't really make all the stuff that they can't make all the stuff to eventually become a sphere-like structure. But that doesn't mean that this objects are boring. On the contrary, in my opinion, on the contrary, they're actually pretty interesting because they can do a lot of things. We have many asteroids that are known to have moons, sometimes not just one, it could be multiple. And we also know that some asteroids can eject stuff into space. This sometimes complicates things because when the things are active, what we'll call it active, you know, sending dust and gas into the interplanetary space, it's traditionally known as a comet. So this create like a gray zone between asteroids and comets. What's an asteroid? What's a comet? If you go to ask a planetary astronomer, and if you want to have a fight, you can try to ask him whether he thinks a certain object is a comet or asteroid or not. But of course, this naturally leads us to another side of the spectrum, which is comets. So comets bear the name because, I want to say is comets are pretty distinct from other objects. And I don't quite remember where the name comet, maybe it comes from. I have a faint memory of it coming from some sort of word that means a hair, hair-like object. I don't know if that's right. Maybe you guys can correct me. But that's certainly what, at least what the bright comets looks like. And in other languages, I know that in Chinese, for example, and I think in Japanese and some other languages too, that the name of comets do actually just mean hair-like objects. Hmm. I think, did someone want to say something? And by the way, if you have questions or if you want to ask something, feel free to interrupt or either raise your hand or just interrupt and ask questions, okay? Okay, this bright comets, you know, they have a comma on the tail. And they have common tail because they have volatile species on their surface or their subsurface. And when they get close to the sun, this volatile species, things like water ice, got warm up. And they sublimate into the interplanetary space and carry the dust and gas from the surface as they, you know, got delivered in the space. And that's why comets are pretty, they don't look like other objects, you know, they have tails, they have, you know, comet. And of course, when we send spacecraft to visit them in situ, we see pretty much what this looks like, you know. You have something that's also very irregular, similar to asteroid in some sort, but they do deliver stuff in space. Halley's Comet, Halley 2, and more recently, Churyumov-Gerasimenko, visited by Rosetta spacecraft. But when comets are away from the sun, they behave pretty much like what I just showed, a distant asteroid. Just a tiny fuzzy blob, faint, and you need a long time integration to detect them. And further, if you look further, comets actually have connections to the region that we know as the Kuiper Belt. So Kuiper Belt, it's at the edge of solar system, and its repository is understood as a repository of icy objects. And due to planetary perturbations, mostly planetary perturbations, some objects in the Kuiper Belt can and do change their orbits. Some change their orbits into more elongated shape. That means they can either travel out and sometimes away from the solar system, or sometimes they get in. They can come into the inner part of the solar system, and by the time that the cold ice on their surface feel the warmth of the sun and start to sublimate, and then they become a comet. And if you compare the images of the comets that we have visited and also the Kuiper Belt object that we visited, well, by now there is only one small Kuiper Belt body that we have visited, the Arkov, visited by New Horizons spacecraft a few years ago. But if you compare them, you can see something really interesting. You can see that, by the shape, they actually look pretty similar to each other. Of course, like if you compare comet Churyumov, Gerasimenko, and Arakov, the scale is different. Arakov is a lot larger than CG, but they do have pretty similar shape. The only difference is that CG is, badly damaged. By repeated revolutions around the sun, and many of the stars have already gone into the interplanetary space. So, okay, and hopefully now I give you a very quick, brief look of a few important types of small bodies in our solar system, and why do we study them? And John already gave a very, very nice summary of this. And the first and foremost, the most important thing is that this object, these small bodies, are relics from the formation stage of solar system. Why we call them relics? Because they're so small, they're too small to have significant geological process on their surface to alter their materials. If you look at big planets, like for example, Earth, Mars, Mercury, Venus, they're so big, they're too big. They have a lot of things going on their surface. So many things have changed since the formations, the planetary formation stage. But for the small bodies, things are different because they're too small to have such processes. So they preserve many materials, although still many of the stuff got changed, but still compared to big planets, they are like fossils from the early part of the solar system. So by studying them, we can get some idea of what happened in the past. And when I say fossils, I didn't just mean like the materials. It can also mean other things. Because of their numerous numbers, small bodies can be used as a tracer of what happens to the big planets in the past. For example, by studying the structures of the small bodies, the asteroid belt, we have now established that Jupiter, for example, Jupiter and Saturn, maybe more primarily Jupiter, wasn't born at the place that it is today. Jupiter actually moved inwards and then outwards in the very distant part, very distant history of solar system, and severely disrupt this asteroid belt in the process. And produce the asteroid belt as we've seen today. So small bodies can be used as a tracer to trace what happened dynamically in the past of the solar system. And we just mentioned that comets have water ice, and also asteroids. Some asteroids also have water ice. That means, and we know that water is the important indigen for life. And there are also some primitive materials on comets already detected that have some building blocks for life. So by studying small bodies, we can also get some idea about origins of water and also life. And all this is very, very important, fascinating stuff. And we just mentioned our exoplanets, and all of the exoplanet systems are so far from us that we can't resolve them. So solar system and small bodies in the solar system provide us a unique and irreplaceable example of what small bodies or what these small planetesimals are like in exoplanet systems. So they provide context for exoplanet systems. And I guess occasionally you can hear news about an asteroid is going to pass very close to the Earth, or you know, well, actually in a few weeks, NASA and ESA is going to conduct experiment in the names of planetary defense, trying to hit hidden near Earth asteroids with a kinetic impactor to try to study what this does to the effect of altering orbits of asteroids. And it has been established that near Earth asteroids and comets can and do and did occasionally impact the Earth and other terrestrial planets. So they're impact corridors, to be understood. And lastly, of course, they are cool to watch. Bright comets are fascinating objects, not just to astronomers, but also to the general public. And we all know about that. Okay, great. So let me try to move slowly to our central topic, the interstellar objects. So one important thing, important properties about small bodies, actually about any celestial objects you can think of, is their orbits. Okay, maybe I should say planets, because when we talk about galaxies and stars, they do have orbits, but we kind of not, you know, when we talk about orbits of galaxies and stars, it's kind of like a orbits in another sense. But anyway, so we talk about orbits of small bodies and planets. And orbits can be defined by 5 to 6 parameters. And one of them is known as orbital eccentricity. And in a nutshell, eccentricity defines how screech orbit is. If you have an eccentricity of 0, it means a perfect circle. And if you goes, you know, if eccentricity goes higher and higher, the orbit becomes more and more elongated. And at a certain point, it just blows up. It transits from an enclosed orbit to an open orbit. And I think one illustration that I really like is this, the cone illustration, I like to call it. So imagine that you have one or two cones here, you have two cones, and you have a plane that intersects it. So if this plane is in parallel to the base of the top of the cone, you have a perfect circle. And this intersection will have an eccentricity of 0, right? It's just a perfect circle. But as you start to tilt it, okay, if you start tilting it, you will end up have an orbit that's more and more elongated. The eccentricity will slowly goes up, you know, from 0 slowly to 1 when you have this plane in parallel with the side of the cone. And another way of looking at it is that, you know, this segments of the intersected planes will go to infinity, meaning that if you are something that's orbiting, it's moving along these lines, it will not come back. Okay, it will just go and go. It will not come back. And of course, if you keep going, this will open more and more. Okay, but in either case, it will not come back. It changed from a periodical object to a non-periodical object. And it has been hypothesized and investigated whether we can have small bodies of eccentricity equal or larger than one. And of course, theoretically, this can happen, right? The simple case is that if you have something that comes very close to a major planet, a very massive planet like Jupiter, and the perturbation, gravitational perturbation from Jupiter can disrupt the orbit of this said object to a stage that will just never come back. Actually, this had happened in the past. This is actually why we know that you know, the planetary migration, the large motion of the planet, Jupiter's orbit happened in the past, because the movement of Jupiter disrupt the asteroid belt and send a lot of stuff, actually about 99% of stuff in the asteroid belt into such open orbit. So they will never come back. So in the current context, if you want to look for interstellar objects, that we want, we will want to have something that have an eccentricity of larger than one. Okay, because this means that they're on the open orbit, they can't visit us once and they will never come back. So, well, sounds like it's easy peasy, right? We just go to a catalog and try to look for things that are with eccentricity larger than one. But it's as many things is easy to said than done. There are some caveats here. Let's start thinking about it. So first, we just mentioned that comets are active objects. They send a lot of stuff into space. This means that comets are easier to detect than their asteroidal counterparts. Why? Because they eject stuff into space. So if you have one kilometer size asteroid and 1 kilometer size comet, which one's easier to detect? Well, when it's far from the sun, the asteroids might be easier to detect because cometary nuclei are some of the darkest objects in the solar system. They're certainly very dark. They reflect on average about 4% of the light from the sun. Whereas some asteroids can reflect up to, I think, 50% or maybe more light from the sun. But if a comet is traveling close, you know, approaching the sun, it starts sending stuff into the space, which increases their scattering area, and making them much, much easier to detect than asteroids. So caveat one here is that an interstellar comet is going to be much easier, potentially much, much easier to detect than interstellar asteroids. And the caveat two here is that an interstellar comet that approached the sun to a distance where the volatiles on the surface become start sublimating is going to be easier to detect than the things that are farther away. Okay. So, and the next, we mentioned that when eccentricity is larger than one, eccentricity of E is larger than one is on the open orbit. But the complication here is that this E is entangled with perihelion distance and speed. So let's think about it. We talk about orbital mechanics because there is a central body, okay? In our case, it's the sun. And there's a central body that governs the motion of this small body. So if you have something that's traveling very far from the sun, it's not going to feel the gravitational pull from the sun in the same way as something that travels very close to the sun. So that means that if you have something that's far from the sun, it's going to move in a more straight trajectory because it's not going to feel the gravitational pull of the sun as at the same level as something that travels close to the sun. So they're going to have a higher E. Whereas you have something travel close to the sun, the E can be lower, okay? And another thing is that the speed of these small bodies also matters. If you have something that's traveling very fast, it won't have as much time to feel the gravitational pull on the sun compared to something that travels slow. And this can also change E. Okay, so so we already have something like a modification factor here. Another way to present this is that when you're trying to tell something from an interstellar object apart from other solar system stuff, you will check the E, and if E is higher, of course, it stands out. Better than the things that are something that's around the borderline. Okay, so we want to look for something that has a higher E. However, the cover three here is that something that's distant, very far from the sun. We already mentioned that it is an interstellar comet is probably not active because it's far from the sun. And also because it's far, it's faint. It's hard to detect, hard to follow up. And for something that's fast, of course, it will also have a higher E because the trajectory is not going to be modified as much as something that travels slow. So they're ideal for data analyzers because they are higher E, but they're also for observers, they're hard to detect, hard to follow up. Okay. So all I want to say here is that for observers, we are far more likely to detect something that has a lower E because they're either close to the sun or they don't move as fast. So we have time to detect and to properly follow up them. But then this becomes, you know, there, as we will see in the next slide, these objects tend to have something that's close to E that makes them hard, that make us pretty hard to distinguish them from things that are close, you know, things that are in the solar system, but very close to borderline. So in summary, our sampling, our actual investigation here is heavily dictated by first the observational capability, you know, how fast, how efficient can we detect things that are sometimes faint, and also by orbital dynamics. Okay, so let's get our hand dirty with some real data here. So here, this is something, this is a histogram of the eccentricity E of the known objects. Known objects are already in our catalog. And here we can see that, you know, there is a spike here. And this in part is a data artifact. Meaning that this is not really what might be happening, but because for some comets, especially the ones that detect many years ago, where we don't have a lot of data on, orbital computers tend to assume that this has E equals one, okay? Because we don't have enough data to better constrain the E. So keep this in mind. But anyway, we'll be most interested at things that, you know, to the right-hand side, of things equals one. Okay, and there's a small shift here. I think things that that have right at one probably got lumped together to this bin. Okay, so this doesn't mean that this big spike contains all interesting stuff. Anyway, so we can see there are maybe in the order of a few hundred here that have eccentricity quite a bit bigger than one. So let's take a look at them here. And by the way, this does not include the two star objects that we have discovered. Here just includes everything discovered before, well, effectively before 2017. And we can see, indeed, there are a couple of interesting stuff here. Yamandrana and, you know, your aunt's doing there, already in the air saying, oh yeah, we have something interesting here. Except that you need to look at the uncertainty too, okay? Because we want to have something that we call statistically significant, meaning that you can confidently say that hey, this is really something that we are looking for instead of something that has not so precise data that can complicate things. So here, there are three columns, the names, E and also E sigma is the uncertainty of the E. And if you look at these numbers, you realize that, in almost all cases, the uncertainty is pretty big. That you can't really say that if the E is really bigger than one. We only know that the nominal number of the E is indeed slightly larger than one. But the uncertainty it also encompasses the range is smaller than one. So you can't really say for sure that these objects really have things bigger than one. With the exception of maybe 1918 E1, well, could this be the things that we're looking for? Not quite. Because I mentioned that close encounters with major planets can modify the orbits of small bodies, okay? If you have something that have a close encounter with Jupiter or Saturn, or in most cases, Jupiter, it can tweak the orbit a bit and maybe make the orbit more elongated, slightly more elongated, or maybe slightly more, push it over the edge and make it slightly larger than one or maybe smaller than one. But the case here is that we want to rule this out. So in short, if there for something that's this close to one, and you also want to check whether it has, you know, an orbital plane that's close to an ecliptic plane too, right? Because if it is, then that means there's a good chance that it has encountered a major planet in the past. Anyway, at the end of the day, I think the case of 1980 E1 Bowell can be best described as an interesting but not significant case. And I think most people agree that this is probably due to a previous close encounter with major planet instead of something really from the interstellar space. If you have nothing interesting in hand, what can you do? Well, for scientists, a joke that we make is that you can put the upper limit, which is still to be fair, this is still very important because this gives you what is the limit that, you know, what is the limit of things. You know that it's not there, and now you can have some sort of range knowing that it's really not as common as you thought. So this has been done several times in the past. Here is the x-axis here is the research of such work. And the y-axis here is more interesting, is the spatial number density of interstellar objects or ISOs. The constraint or constraints placed by such study. Okay, and the solid line here is with the assumption that all interstellar objects are asteroidal, meaning that they don't eject stuff, making it harder to see. But the dashed line here I won't try to distinguish the dashed line and the dot line, but both of them roughly means that if represents the case where the interstellar objects are comets and they do become active and they will become detectable in some ways. So as you can see, a quick impression here is that for this free research work here, they will suggest that, well, based on the assumption that they made, if their assumption that they made is true, then, and if all the ISOs are indeed, or most of the ISOs are indeed comets and become detectable at some time, then we should have probably detect some ISOs. The fact that they have not been detected means that, well, there must be something wrong with assumptions. Either the numbers are not that many, there were not that many ISOs, or they don't become active in the same way that we thought.
So are these estimates?
These are the upper limits based on the non-detections of interstellar objects.
Okay.
Yeah. They are in certain ways estimates, but they are educated estimates.
Okay.
Okay. So that's why. So all this leads to the work by Eckhart et al. 2017 concluded that the prospect of identifying ISOs passing through all citizen appeared to be bleak. Well, this actually happens only 7 months before the first interstellar object was discovered. So okay, all right. So well, I did. So in only 7 months, things happen. So what happened exactly was that you might have heard of that. We have planetary defenders or a group of telescopes that scans the entire sky every night for incoming asteroids, okay? For near Earth asteroids. And at first, this detection didn't go bananas from the first second, okay? It just appeared to be another regular submission from a telescope in Hawaii. You know, it goes to a web page known as the Near Earth Object Confirmation page, where usually there are like between maybe 10 to 50 objects, possible near-Earth asteroids waiting to be confirmed. And this was at first just another one, you know, it didn't have a much fanfare when it was first detected. It was only, I think, about 24 hours later when there are people who did follow-up observations, make measurements of its precise positions, and the orbital computers start to notice something very strange. Namely, they can't fit the data into orbit with an eccentricity smaller than one. Now, with all this great physics that we have discovered since Newton's time, we have developed a very mature way of detecting, of measuring orbit of newly found objects based on a handful of position and time measurements that people make. So if you start seeing something strange, I think the first reactions of people is usually to go back and check if they have done something wrong. But no, in this case, first this comes from many stations, many observatories. You can't, if it's just one, then maybe you can assume that somebody did something wrong somewhere. But it's hard for everybody, all people to make mistake, right? So, this is where things start to become very interesting and heated. People were, looking to each other and said, did we finally detect the first interstellar visitors? And to make things worse, of course, all things usually come with a drama, is that this happened during WAS, or the American Astronomical Society's annual planetary meeting. Meaning that, people are there busy with attending talks, preparing talks, with little time to do, control telescopes and make measurements. So it's pretty hard week for everybody who's monitoring this, because you basically have to multitask. I should maybe say a few things about how telescope times got allotted to people. Because to the general public, they might have an impression like, oh, if you have something interesting, you just, go to the telescope, you give somebody a call, maybe not the president, but maybe president of the observatory or something, give a call, say, hey, I have a pretty important stuff. Can you observe for me? It didn't happen that way. Usually what happens is that we write a proposal, like a document. We all hate paperwork, but this is what we have to do. We have to write usually a few pages saying that why we want to observe this thing. Usually twice a year. There's the only opportunities of twice a year that you can apply for such time. And somebody, a small closed door committee will review all the proposals. They will make a decision whether this is worth pursuing, and they give you time. So although a small amount of time is kept for sudden things like this, is a small amount of time. Usually things are, arranged well in advance of time. So that means you do need to go some extra steps. Although I think most people have connections, usually you write something in emergency saying that we want to observe this because this is really important and we just learned about it yesterday. Or sometimes you just go to your friends and say, hey, I have something. Do you think you have 10 minutes? I think this is what happened in many of the cases here, that people help each other out. Anyway, after about 2 weeks, it became pretty certain that this is indeed has a pretty significant eccentricity. It's not like 1.08 as we just saw about 1980 comet. It has E of 1.2. And also, this is significant because this object, now known as Oumuamua, has passed the sun approached the sun by only, I think, 0.2 astronomical units or so, where that 1980 comet passed pretty far from the sun. So this is another aspect that you can tell, this seems to be right because it passed close to the sun. And usually things pass close to the sun. If you remember the slide from a few, the message from a few slides ago, that things pass close to the sun, usually you would expect the eccentricity to be very close to one, but this at 1.2 is actually highest ever measured at that time. And the name Oumuamua, in case you wonder, means the first messenger from afar. So, appropriate for the title of this talk. And the first thing that people notice right from day one is that very strangely, this object appeared to be inactive, as opposed to all these assumptions that we have made, that the first interstellar objects likely to be comet, because They are, first, they are easier to detect, and second, I did not mention, but in retrospect, you think that it makes sense. That's because comets tend to have an elongated object, elongated orbits. That means some of them will pass close to the major planets. That means that they're easy to be, you know, kicked out from the planetary system. So there should be more like comet or icy stuff ejected from the system compared to asteroidal stuff, which for now are, you know, mostly in a circular, near circular orbit, more stable, and harder to be kicked out from the planetary system. So no matter, there has been some very intense, many very, very deep exposures, and none of them show any comma or tail from the object. And for the case of Oumuamua, it was also kind of challenging because, as it later turns out, it already passed the Perihelion. That happened about a month before it was first discovered and was rapidly fading. So meaning that being time is ticking to collect more data of this object. And there were no detections before around the perihelion, although recent, I mean about 3 years ago, my colleague Mantel Hui and Matthew Knight goes back into the data collected for solar observations. Well, this is a nice thing about collecting data, because you never know what's in the data. Even though this data is for people who study the sun, they have turned out to be very useful for the study of comets, because when comets approach the sun, they also become bright. And for regular ground-based observers, they are hard to detect because you don't want to point your telescope to the sun, right? So that means that you can only study them using this data. So they use those data for to try to see if they can really see this object. Then the answer is no, meaning that this object probably wasn't very active when it was near the sun. And another work that I had the honor to lead is to use meteor showers, because Oumuamua happened to pass very close to the Earth, meaning that if there were some, if it ejected dust well before it was discovered, then this dust could arrive at Earth and therefore can be detected as meteor showers. So we use a meteor radar in Canada, where I did my PhD for that, trying to do a search. Here is a radian map. This cross is the predicted radian of any Oumuamua-related ejections. And this is the activity of this spot for our year. And you can see that, well, there's nothing there. So this tells us the first important properties that we know about Oumuamua is that, well, there's no comet, even despite very sensitive and multi-approach search. And the second is that by measuring the lights, the trench of lights, you can figure out its shape. And why is that? Well, imagine that you have something elongated, you're rotating in front of you. And when the sideways, when it's, the long side is facing you, then it reflects more light and it will become brighter. And when its short side is facing you, then there's, it's a smaller cross-section, there's more light reaching your eyes, then you become fader. And by measuring this, what we call light curve, you can start figuring out the shape. So Oumuamua was characterized with a very large amplitude of this light curve. And from this, we established that the axis ratio is about over 6 to 1, meaning that this object is very elongated. It is actually, I think, the most elongated natural objects that we ever detect. And spectrum, by measuring how the brightness of light over the wavelength, we know that it's pretty red. It's actually pretty consistent with cometary nuclei, even though it doesn't seem to behave like a comet. And the fourth, and perhaps the most interesting and difficult to understand behavior is that there is a significant non-gravitational accelerations. In other words, there seems to be another, if you have something that's not jetting or releasing anything, its motion around a massive body like the sun should just follow Newtonian dynamics, right? But if it ejects stuff, just imagine that you have a rocket that's, you know, releasing gas, then this give you a small momentum that will alter its trajectory very slightly. So by measuring the positions of Oumuamua over time very precisely, a significant non-gravitational acceleration is detected. This is usually detected among active comets, but very rarely among asteroids. So this is a very puzzling property of Oumuamua. Why is that? It is not a comet, and why does it have a non-gravitational acceleration? So this is the Hubble measurements that the group make to detect a non-gravitational acceleration. Here's a histogram of all objects with a large gravitational non-gravitational acceleration. The point here is that the non-gravitational acceleration over Oumuamua is among the strongest ever measured, marked by the black line here. And this is pretty funny, but pretty interesting, but I see that I'm starting to run out of time, is that the group start to, you know, generating make up image of the Hubble image to try to see how sensitive can we detect if there have been some dust ejections. And I think the conclusion is that it's actually pretty sensitive to the order of, I think, a few kilograms per second, meaning that there haven't been things larger than a few kilograms per second of material release at, two kilogram dust. If there's anything more than 2 kilograms, then we should have already detected. And for your compacts, usually an active comet, very bright comet, usually release a few pounds of dust per second. So this is a very sensitive search. There have been a number of theories putting forward trying to explain the elongated shape, non-gravitation motion of Oumuamua. And you probably have heard of a certain group that's keep advocating the idea that it's alien technology. And I guess you probably have this question, want to see what I say about it. I think for now, all these properties of Oumuamua is certainly pretty unusual, they can still be explained by knowing natural processes, like the elongation could probably come from like objects that come very close to a central star and then got stretched. For the non-gravitational acceleration, this could come from gas instead of dust, because of its faintness, direct search are targeted on the dust instead of gas. So if there has been some gas release, we wouldn't have detected. Okay. And the last thing here is the origin of Oumuamua. This is another interesting question. Can we trace its origin system? We have a very precise measurement of its trajectory, which is great, but still the universe is so vast that if you really look into it, this ellipse here on the sky map show us the origin, the point or the area of the region of origin from Oumuamua. If you project it into 100 parsecs from here, this certainly actually goes to average stellar distance, mean distance between stars. So this means that it's pretty hard to backtrace Oumuamua or any Oumuamua-like objects unless we have another significant progress in measuring, advance in measuring the positions, because the uncertainty is so big. Okay, just as people try to make sense of the discovery of Oumuamua and what it means to study of interstellar objects, another interstellar object got discovered only 2 years later. Again, this time it was discovered just before the annual WS planetary meeting. So people are still, again, very nervous about it. And by the way, if you're an observer, the next annual WAS meeting is coming up in about less than a month. So if you are in the mood of trying to find the next interstellar object, then maybe now is a good time to keep an eye on them. And this object. Now this time things are a little bit wacky, less wacky than Oumuamua. The eccentricity is very high, it's about 3, but in fairness, this object at its closest to the sun is about 2 astronomical units from the sun compared to Oumuamua's 0.2. So it's not surprise that the eccentricities are pretty high. And as expected, this is a comet. It has a comma, it's a tail, and was discovered as a Pegasus, meaning that we got about a bit more than a year to study them compared to Oumuamua's less than a few months. But the interesting thing here is that it was not found by professional astronomers, by an amateur astronomer in Crimea, Gennady Borisov. And why is that? Not because the professional astronomers are not doing their job, but because this falls into an interesting niche here. Oh, I see that I'm really short on time, so I try to keep it short. It was only 38 degrees elongation, meaning that 38 degrees from the sun when it was discovered. And as you can imagine, big telescopes don't want to point close to the sun because it's risky. And that's usually not, you know, the observational window shot. So meaning that there's not much thing you can do about things there. Although the Zwicky Transit facility using a 1.2 meter wide field telescope, you know, doing daily, nightly scan of the entire sky at that time, we just start something called a twilight survey, meaning that we use the short twilight to search things close to the sun to try in hope to discover first things called asteroids well inside the orbit of Earth, and second, comets that happen to approach us from the other side of the sun. And certainly we were not running at that time because the time that we are awarded from November to January back in that time, November to January, and then we also did some test runs in May. So we didn't find it, but the survey data back in May provided recovery data, meaning that we can, once this object was discovered, we can go back into the data and search for it. And here, without going into great details, here are the pre-recovery detections of Borisov as approached to the sun. And the message here is first, using this data, we can establish the brightening, how the comet brightens, and compare it to the solar system comet. And we found that it's very similar to long period solar system comets. And the second, this helps us to trace its incoming directions and reveal a recent encounter, even though not origin, from a star system called ROS 573. So in terms of known properties, it appears to be another regular, if not boring, comet. The behavior and chemistry is similar to at least some solar system comet. There are some research showing that it's carbon depleted, which is very interesting, but we have seen it in a few comets before. And it also fragmented into two, and when it passed the perihelion, again, it's not too out of the way from solar system comets. We know that solar system comets fragment from time to time. All right, so here comes the finale. The story here is that we had nothing in 20 plus years, and suddenly we have 2 in 3 years. So is this just a fluctuation of statistics, or did we just go lucky? Well, we don't quite know yet, but it's certainly worth to keep an eye and see what's going on the next like 10, 20 years. And to this extent, the new Vera Rubin observatories in Chile, previously known as the Large Synoptic Sky Survey, now known as the Legacy Survey of Space and Time, whatever the name, will help us to find more, may help us to find more, or at least place a good constraint on what might be happening. Their most recent simulation suggests that the VRO observatory will likely detect 15 interstellar objects in over its 10 years lifetime. So let's hope that that's the case, but it will be equally exciting if it's not. And we also don't know if Oumuamua-like object is common, if we just got very lucky or unlucky on the first, you know, visitors, or is comet Borisov more representative of exocomets. And now we live in an exciting time of space age, and there have been bots and also real missions that have been put in place to catch the next interstellar objects that are visiting us. Folks have, you know, kind of the idea to catch an Oumuamua that will probably happen if they do get approved and funding the money. That will probably happen in 30 years time. And the Flintstone lockout is the Comet Interceptor mission led by ESA and joined by, I think, NASA and also JAXA in Japan. It will launch in 2029. The idea is that the spacecraft will be put on the spot, known as the Lagrangian second L2 spot, that requires minimal fuel to maintain its position and wait, and then stand by there to wait for super targets. Then an object will just go to visit it when the super target is discovered. Okay, I guess we have talked about a lot of things. I guess I should probably stop here and see if anybody has questions. Thank you very much.
Okay. Are there any questions?
I have a question.
Go ahead, Carl.
You may have mentioned this, but did Oumuamua have a higher velocity than you would have expected from a typical solar system object?
Certainly it has a much higher incoming velocity, because this is the first target that we are sure come from outside the solar system. So here when we mention velocity, we are using the infinity speed velocity, meaning that if you place things at infinity, another way of saying this is that if you account for a solar gravitational pull from the sun, because if you just talk about speed or velocity, velocity is just a speed of a vector, a direction, right? Then of course, things that are closer to the sun will have a higher velocity, simply because it's a deeper part of the solar gravity well. So when we compare things, we want to use the velocity that has been accounted for solar gravitational pull from the sun. So in this case, Oumuamua certainly have a much higher infinity velocity compared to other solar system objects, which is at most no more than a few kilometers per second, if I remember correctly. Whereas for Oumuamua, I think it's 20 kilometers per second or something like that.
Thank you.
Other questions? I had a couple. I was wondering with Jeff Gerber how much, 3D trigonometry, calculus of many variables and statistics you have to know in order to figure out what the eccentricity of a given orbit is from just a handful of observations.
This is a pretty hard question to answer, because the answer is it depends. But to give you, to try to visualize things a bit more, this really depends on the geometry of the set object. If you have something, because remember that what we have here, when you try to measure things, for example, if you want to tell we want to tell where the cat is in the room, we know it because we have two eyes, we have like a 3D thing, and we can figure out the distance, right? Whereas for small body measurements, what we call astrometry, we relied on a moving platform, which is our Earth, moving through the interplanetary space, and 2D measurements of our target. Actually 3D, but this is not XYZ, but time, RA and DAC, okay? RA and declination. So this will depend on how all the motions of this body plays out. If we have something that's coming right at us, then it's hard to tell whether this is just a very distant object that's not moving much over the course of the time, or is really coming towards us. But as a rule of thumb, in general, usually you can tell things apart. You can tell things apart if you have good measurements spanning over maybe a day or two. In the more difficult cases, it can require a slightly longer time to figure things out. In the case of Oumuamua, it took about a day to show that this is really unusual. And I think it took about 2 days, certainly no more than half a week, to be able to pretty confidently tell tell with confidence that this is really, really an unusual object.
I wonder how much time and data they needed for things like discovering the Uranus and Neptune. I wonder how much data they needed back then when it was all done by hand and tables of logarithms and stuff like that. Must have taken a long time.
Yeah, I think back at that time that, well, for now we have the luxury of computers, which will do all that for us in that, you know, just a thing of light from the eyes.
Right.
Yeah, usually now if you have a good astrometry, you just move it to a software and it will do it for you in less than a second. I guess back at that time, it probably takes as much time to, you know, wait for the Earth and Uranus to do their thing as to compute their orbit.
Well, we've had.
I don't remember.
None of us, none of us alive today remember it. But there was a day when a computer meant a woman who did the computations.
That's right.
And people like Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin got, cheated out of a Nobel Prize because some fellow took credit for her discoveries. And I was trying to wonder, why do those programs assume that the eccentricity is going to equal exactly one? I mean, it could be anything. They could have found something that's on some elliptical orbit as opposed to a perfect paraboloid, which is E1, I think, right?
Yeah. It's just for simplicity, because one is a simple thing that you consume. Of course, you can try to feed the data with an elliptical orbit, which will imply that they are on a periodical orbit. But in most cases, you know that that don't happen because you don't observe the comet coming back, with the exception of things like Halley's Comet. So E=1 is, you know, the simplest assumption.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so did I understand from John's introduction, you've discovered personally a bunch of comets?
Yeah, I found a few.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, thank you.
So was it digging in the data basically, or, you know, the old fashioned way, looking through a telescope at dawn or dusk?
Oh, I didn't. I mean, we did, you know, control the telescope, decide where to look, and have the heaviest part of the work is done by computer, which is, you know, searching through the image and try to look for things that move, and we confirm them.
Okay.
It's certainly, yeah, I think visual discover like dawn,
those days are gone.
It's certainly not the it's certainly not comparable to the effort,
right?
In the time, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if you remember jumping beans. When I was a kid, they had these beans that had actually a little larva inside a bean, and if you pick them up, they would warm up in your hand, and these little beans would start jumping around because there was a little live bean in there. They don't do that anymore, but I guess you've ruled out jumping beans as the non-gravitational acceleration on the Oumuamua, right?
That's right. And I like that analogy. I like that example. Yes, that's right. Yeah,
that's rolled out. Okay.
Yeah. You can tell that there is something that purports within itself, rather than the sun doing all the gravity of the sun doing all the work.
Okay. All right. Any other questions?
Is your name attached to any of the comets that you've discovered?
That's a bit complicated. I do have one comet that's named after Ye. For Comet Lulin, that was named after the observatory. There's a little bit of details here, because if you report it as a comet, then it can bear your name, assuming that you don't have more than 3 person. But if you report it as an asteroid, then usually they prefer single name, which will be the observatory itself.
I would think that the occurrence of interstellar planetary objects is rather rare in the solar system, because of, for several reasons. One being that objects do not often escape from planetary systems. We have not seen objects escape from our system. We know that some have, but it takes quite a lot of velocity for an object to have to escape from the system. And plus, the solar system has a rather small footprint as far as objects moving through space. And of course, we've only discovered a few interstellar planetary objects, which sort of reinforces that idea. But they're certainly valuable, and it's good that we're looking for them on a continuous basis.
Yeah, so I guess when Vera Rubin comes online, I guess it will, as I said, it will be equally exciting no matter whether we found 15 ISOs in 10 years, or we found 150, or we found now. Because this will tell us something about our understanding of how planetary systems handle its black visibles. Do they just, release a lot of stuff, eject a lot of stuff? Do they keep, for some reason, do they not eject that many stuff?
On that non-gravitational acceleration, is it a magnetized object? Does it have a magnetic field?
No, it's too small to feel. So it's either the object itself is too small to too big to be by some magnetic field, and the object itself is too small to generate significant.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you think of Avi Loeb's speculation that it's Oumuamua's alien technology?
I will say that we already have ways to explain this we have ways to explain this as a natural object. You can say that certainly available data you can interpret it that way, but I would say that's speculative at best. That's my understanding. Because if you can explain things, well, that's outcome theorem, right? If you can explain things using simpler method, why do you bother with the more complicated one?
Right.
Yeah. So that's my take.
I had a question on some the previous comment or two. I thought you said something 90% of the objects that get gravitationally really flung by Jupiter actually get flung out of the solar system, or do they end up in Oort cloud or Kuiper belt? That's a question.
Yeah, that's about 99% of stuff that have gone.
So it's gone.
It's gone. Yeah, it's being ejected from the solar system.
Okay. And this is so then it's going.
Why? Yes, please.
other fate is that they get thrown into the sun.
Yeah, but that's still a small probability.
Okay.
Because the sun is it's big, but it's still a pretty small object. If you look at the whole thing, right? The sun's big, but it only takes a very small space in the whole solar system. So some of them do collide with the sun, but most of them just eject from the sun.
So every solar system is probably got lots and lots and lots of things that have been ejected from it. Most of them not very big, and so they're out there. Of course, space is really, really, really big, and the distances between solar, systems are vast, unless you happen to live in a globular cluster or something like that.
Yeah.
So, I think, it's too early to speculate how many we can expect to see coming through a a parsec cubed or something. Need a little bit more data.
Yeah, but in the upper limit that I show here, people did make those kind of like order of magnitude estimates and see based on and have asked the question that based on our current understanding of how many stuff got ejected from planetary systems, how many planetary systems are there, how many interstellar objects that we have, that we should have seen. And clearly there is something going on there that we don't understand that well. So that's why, when we have more sensitive search, like the Vera Rubin Observatory coming online, when we have a better grasp of how to interpret of the exact numbers of ISOs that are passing through the solar system, we can have a better understanding of all these assumptions and see which makes sense and which needs to be updated.
Good. Any other questions?
Yeah, I had one. You had an image of a color image of I think it was Arakoth. Arakoth. It was on a slide with a number of black and white images of that one.
Yeah.
And, I was wondering if that is a true color.
It depends on how you define true color. My recollection is that this tried to be as true color as possible. Okay, all right, I guess without complicating, the short answer is yes, I think this is a true color.
Okay.
And you can see that it's slightly reddish because of the deposits known as the toluene deposit on the surface.
I would say that's more than slightly reddish. That is quite rusty orange, in my opinion. So I was wondering if either it was true color or maybe the correct hue, but it enhanced them, or if it was a false color. So
I think the definition of true color that I use is that you try to match the color perceived by human eyes, although in some cases may not be perfect, but you try to match, blue to blue, green to green, and red to red. And I think this can be called true color. I guess when you call it false color, when you try to match things like infrared to near infrared to blue, far infrared to red, things like that. Because in that scenario, you're dealing with a wavelength that's invisible to human eyes.
Right, but sometimes they also do what would be true color, but they increase the saturation, and so that the colors are more intense. So.
There's also some. They also sometimes do that, but I think that's not not the case here. If my memory is right, I think I've come across some enhanced colored image returned by spacecraft, and I don't think this one got the model in.
Okay, thanks.
And I agree. It's a bit of potato color. I think maybe this goes to maybe another joke by astronomers that sometimes people are quite binary. It's either bluish or reddish, or everything in the universe is hydrogen, helium, or heavy metal. So we make some strange or even funny simplifications of the word. So yeah. But great, it looks pretty brown, maybe orangish or brownish, using daily vocabulary.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, I would like to
One comment.
Oh, comment.
I was just going to say that picture of Arakoth is actually combining two images, one with the high-resolution Lowry instrument, which is black and white camera, but there was another camera. I think it's the Ralph camera that took a color image, but much lower resolution. And so they just combined the colors of the Ralph instrument with the high-resolution Lowry, and I think they tried to make it true color, but as I mentioned before, they often try to enhance the colors to make it more what the human eye would perceive to distinguish things.
So in the chat, I posted a link to the webpage that the mission website has on Arakoth, and it talks a little bit about that image.
Thank you, Elizabeth. And keep in mind that it's Elizabeth Warner that keeps all this stuff going for us electronically. And if you haven't paid your dues yet, you need to do that, and you can do it on the webpage. And let's all give Kwangji, I'm probably saying that wrong, a round of applause for a very enlightening talk. Thank you very much. And a couple, that's it. Thank you very much for all coming. And thank you again, Kwangji, for talking to us. Really appreciate that.
Thank you.
You're
welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Kwangji.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, thank you. We'll see everyone next month.
See you, Elizabeth.
Bye.